Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So we are going to continue with the rest of the program for today. And I think so far, I'm just going to give you guys a couple of minutes just to find your seats. So I think we can agree that so far the show has really been really awesome. We've had Kevin Links with an amazing presentation, and of course the speakers that followed were just as great, and then obviously wrapping it up with Gilan Gok just before the tea break. We're now going to have the next presentation, and that is going to be delivered by Jason Liddell. He is the head of institutional at Camissa, and he's going to be talking to us about navigating uncertainty in capital markets, hunting for alpha. So Jason, no pressure. Hopefully you can help us navigate through this period, but please join us on stage.
Thank you very much to Asa, and also for your time. I suppose at the very least I can start opening up the conversation around it. So I'm sure that many of us have engaged with our clients, already possibly implemented changes within their portfolios as a result of the revisions in Regulation 28. We've thought very acutely about how we spend our capital and our risk budgets, all towards their own objectives. And the great news is that there is so much more in our tool set at the moment. So in addition to active, we've got index, we've got quantitative forms of investing, we've got thematic investing, we've got private markets even, and also even currency overlays that can make our portfolio construct a lot more dynamic. I'm not advocating that one needs to unduly change course, but hopefully I can give you some reason for just some renewed pause as we consider the dynamics of the local and the global markets at the moment. There are certainly reasons and there are certainly risks and issues that have presented themselves in the local market from which we would like to get away from, but sometimes a lot of these issues may lay in wait as we actually experience the global markets as well. So the very pointed question I'd like to ask of us as active managers is, can we still add value to our clients in being able to hunt for alpha as we navigate more and more uncertain markets out there? It's no secret that the active management industry has come under a lot of pressure. And, even with that being the case, I'd like to start off on the front foot and really talk to you about why we believe active investing still matters. We'd like to then also consider the quality or the skill set of the actors that have presented themselves in that space and the environment in which they operate, being the global investable universe. We just will dwell on the experience a little bit, and then through the lens of the fundamental law of active management, take a little bit more of a look at how we can actually address some of these risks and issues that I will highlight that we've experienced in the local market as well as the global market by focusing specifically on the breadth issue. I think many of you would have become acquainted in your time in the investment industry with the SPIVA report. It's produced by S&P, and the EVA part is talking to index versus active. And globally, I suppose this is probably one of the reasons why the active investment industry has come under pressure. Many of us may be aware of these stats that active managers have struggled to outperform the indexes, but presented with this picture, I suppose the extent of it may be continue to surprise us in that regard. So I've provided the geographies and the countries in America and the European Union, India, Brazil, as well as Australia. Before I put up South Africa, is there any guesses about whether our experience is better or worse? I'm hearing a bit of a muddle, I'm hearing some mutterings of better. And in that case, you would be right. So I think the key points out of this slide is I really want to point out that there is skill out there, but skill is definitely rare. But in the South African case as well, it also leads us to the questions about what is it about the dynamic of our market that has led to this specific outcome? Is the arithmetic of active management at play here? Are we somehow more skillful than everyone else? Or are there other reasons that we must think about in terms of our experience here? So just considering the playground or the market that everyone plays in, the MSCI indices is a very, very good port of call to understand the key features of the global investing universe. So on the left, you've got the emerging market, and on the right, you've got the developed market index, the so-called MSCI World Index. And just a few things to point out. I think we all appreciate that developed markets are a lot bigger than emerging markets. I'm not quite sure whether you understand the quantum, but the World Index has a market cap of about 74 trillion, and the emerging market has a market cap of about 9 trillion. When you add those together, you get the so-called ACWI Index, or the All Country Index, which many asset managers are benchmarked against. And in terms of the full constituents, there are more than about, you know, 8,700 constituents inside the index, the All Country Index, 5,500 being inside the World Index in developed markets, and 3,500 in emerging markets. Some interesting other features in terms of the top stocks in the developed market. We've got the top three: Microsoft, Nvidia, and Apple. Each of those companies alone have market caps of about $3 trillion. A very surprising stat is the skew that is exhibited in the index through the US, which is now about 71% of that index. And on the emerging market side, you see that Taiwan Semiconductors as a stock is around about 8.3% of the index. China, India, and Taiwan sort of share the spoils with about 20% exposure inside the emerging market index as well. So if we have a look at the global markets experience, is there any risks and issues that we can maybe pick up? And I think the two I wanted to dwell on is the first one being market concentration, and the second one being the concentrated return experience. I wanted to add a third around the dispersion of returns, but it's good that I didn't, given that we are under some time pressures. But I'll make a few remarks on that towards the end, because that also is very important in understanding whether there's an opportunity for active managers to actually add value. So from a market concentration point of view, we'll address it along three dimensions. The first dimension is in terms of what market shares are shared between the various countries. And at the moment, as I mentioned also in the previous slide, you know, the U.S. equity market hasn't been this large a portion of the global equity market since 2004. Interestingly enough, Japan took the mantle in 87 and peaked out in 1989, comprising 49% of the index. So within the index, there are these skews and extremes in concentration that take place from a country point of view. From a stock point of view, the top 10 stocks also at all-time highs. These kinds of levels haven't been seen since the 1970s, and more than 30% of the S&P right now is comprised by the top 10 stocks. From a sector point of view as well, this level of concentration from a sector point of view hasn't been of this ilk since the 1950s. And if I can just take a bit of a minute to pause, it's very interesting because this chart dates all the way back from 1800. And it's very interesting to see how economies transition, you know, technologically and industrially and commercially, and seeing how the sector baton gets handed over from finance and real estate to transport and the great railway expansion to commodities, and how that's fueled the infrastructure booms, and then to IT and communications. From a concentration of returns point of view, what we did here was there was a study done and looked at the ACWI index, or the All Country Index. Remember, the developed market index, and the emerging market index, and they were combined. And we looked at the concentration of the return experience at a constituent level. So from 2000 until 2023, the contributors to the index points were all counted and summed and aggregated over that while. And very interestingly, it was found that the top 5% of the constituents, that being about 364 companies, produced 87% of the returns. The top 1%, which is around about 75 shares, produced about half of those returns. And the remaining 95%, or 6,000 or 7,000 stocks, produced the remaining 13%. So I suppose there's two questions that one wants to ask is, well, how good am I at picking those winners, given the skew that's characterized things for so long? And the second thing being, the other point I wanted to make here is, if you actually look at the top 5% and the profile from a sector point of view, and the sector exposure of the indices themselves, there's no sector bias that exists. The reason why those stocks have outperformed is because they've been innovative, they've been growth stories, they've been thematic pioneers. But again, how do we actually pin them down? So with all of those, or those two risks and issues that we've highlighted now, is there anything that we can draw on to get our hands around how we actually deal with this issue? I always find it useful to trek back to my quant roots, and I found the fundamental law of active management actually quite enlightening in terms of how we address certain of these issues. For many of you that know, the fundamental law just states the value add by an active manager, or its information ratio, its value add above the benchmark, given the risk it's taken and the deviation from the benchmark, is a function of two things: its skill and the breadth of opportunities, and independent opportunities, I might add. So from a skill point of view, it's more commonly known as the information coefficient. It can get distilled down even further to the transfer coefficient and many other things. I won't bore you too much. But what the information coefficient pretty much says is, let's look at our forecasts. Let's rank them from top to bottom. And is there any correlation between that and the out-of-sample outcomes or performance or returns that are yielded by those ideas? And yes, it is a little bit more of an art in terms of being able to pin that down. It's really a function of the quality of the people, the philosophy, the process, the organization, as well as the culture. On the breadth side of things, though, that is really the number of independent forecasts and decisions that are successful also and are taken within a specific manager's portfolio. And that is really a function of your investable universe. So as I mentioned, the one part is the art form. The other part is a little bit more mathematically driven. So let's just hold on a little bit more to the science part of the breadth and start to unpack that and see how those can be addressed inside the local and the global markets. This is just a very interesting table that talks to a manager's ability to exhibit breadth in the local market. We all know that the local market is extremely skewed, it's extremely concentrated, and in this table, we illustrate a manager's ability to actually exhibit that breadth. So on the top header row, you've got an asset manager categorized in billions of AUM from 10 billion, 45, 80, all the way to 200 billion. You've got then along the vertical, a fund that they may be managing, and in aggregate as well, if they were to take 1% or 5% positions inside the fund, against the constraint of the maximum free float that they'd be allowed to take inside a specific company. And what one finds is that if you are 200 billion big, faced with a constraint maybe of, I don't want to own more than 10% of the free float, and taking exposure at a 5% level, your universe of stocks is pretty much restricted mathematically to the top 20. It's very difficult for you to take meaningful positions outside of that at a size of 200 billion. So in terms of how you assess skill, it may not be as important. It's all about the size of an asset manager and its ability to actually take positions and meaningful positions across the full, in the full cross section in the mid cap space as well as the small cap space. On this slide as well, this just talks to the will. Again, we just illustrated the market here in terms of the top 5 shares, the top 10 shares, the top 15 shares, top 20, etc. And the areas are just illustrative of the portion of the total value that are made up by those increments of 5 shares as we keep on adding them. And so you can see the largest 5 stocks pretty much comprise 31% of the index, all the way down to the top 50 stocks making up 90% of the index. And then there is a certain asset manager, who won't name names, you know, does that asset manager have the courage of their conviction to actually take positions in the mid-cap space and add alpha? Because it's really the only way, given the fundamental law on the breadth side of things, to add to the breadth of opportunity and independent forecasts inside your portfolio. Then turning our attention to this massive swell of stocks on the global stage, more than 8,000 of them. Are there things that we can think about and do in including in our investment process? Now, I mentioned that previous study, and we kind of characterized and got a sense of which stocks were the winners. Remember, the top 5% of stocks, meaning 364 companies, drove 87% of the returns in the ACWI. Is there anything interesting and anything workable that we can do inside our processes that's going to help us gravitate around those? I mentioned that the businesses and the companies that did well were the ones that understood the future market environments. They were growth companies, great growth stories, thematic pioneers. So as an asset manager, not that you need to employ thematic investing to its fullest conclusion in terms of what your product looks like, but in addition to quantitative screening, because yes, you do need it, 8,000 stocks, you do need to whittle down a little bit more, it's good if you have an overlay of qualitative thematic scanning. And here you need to take a view about what is the future going to look like. We all know the issues around the aging population. You know, we are probably living in an age where we've got, our kids are probably going to have 100-year lifetimes. The advances in healthcare. We need to understand what tomorrow's workforce is going to look like, the environments that they're in, the future of mobility, from food security, content is king, as well as in terms of the green energy transition. Conversely, it's also very valuable to understand what are those industries in decline, because then those may also be used as negative screeners. So if I think about tobacco or the print media or many other things, those are also stocks that you may want to thematically, negatively screen and scan and gravitate yourself towards the winners. So just to wrap up, as an active manager, if one encounters a skillful active manager, they can dynamically address some of these issues that we've spoken about today in terms of market concentration and the ensuing concentration of return. And a bottom-up approach, one is able to turn the needle a little bit more and harder and at a more granular level to actually approach the structural breadth issues that present themselves in the local and international markets a lot more effectively through meaningful mid and small cap exposure in the local side of things, and then employing just a little bit of thematic and qualitative screening in the international side of things. That, along with high conviction portfolio management, is a way in which one can improve the breadth within your portfolio and add value to your clients over time. Okay. Thanks very much.
So we won't have questions for this particular presentation by Jason, but I don't know if you're going to be around for lunch or if any, are you going to be around for lunch? Sure. So you can approach Jason if you want to talk to him a little bit more about the presentation that he just delivered.